Hello, listeners. I'm Amy McKinnon, National Security Reporter at Foreign Policy, and this is Foreign Policy Playlist. Each week, we help you make sense of the crazy number of podcasts out there by recommending one podcast from somewhere around the world. This week, I'm featuring a new podcast from FP Studios, Foreign Policy's Global Reboot, which looks at how we rebuild and reset in the wake of the pandemic. In just a moment, we're going to play the first episode of the series, which features an interview with US climate envoy John Kerry, who speaks about the Biden administration's efforts to tackle climate change. But first, I spoke with Ravi Agrawal, the host of Global Reboot and editor-in-chief here at Foreign Policy, to learn more about the episode and how the series came to be. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really excited to hear about Global Reboot. Could you just start by telling me a little bit about why this podcast and why now?
Well, I think the notion of Global Reboot, I think, came quite naturally to us because it really feels like this moment is special. It feels like this moment is unprecedented. Never before in living memory, maybe even further back, has the world shut down the way it has, worked remotely for so long, obviously because of the internet and technology, and then come back in the way that it's about to come back. And all of this just has immense repercussions for the way we work, for the way we live, for the way we commute. But also, those are the obvious things, which I think all of us kind of talk about with our friends and our families. Mm-hmm. But then there's the stuff that is a little bit outside of those realms, but will also be affected by the crazy last year that we've all been through. And those things could range from geopolitics, the US-China relationship. It could be climate change, because we're thinking about the world in new and different ways, in part because of the pandemic and what it's wrought. It could be the role of technology in our lives. It could be racism and its impact on societies. I mean, if you look at how the vaccines have been made available at varying rates to different parts of mm-hmm. the population, even within the United States. But then you take that globally and you look at access and equity, and notions of all of these things now, I think, are just being discussed more and more across the board. So Global Reboot, our sense was, we all know about all of these problems. The pandemic could be an opportunity for us to just think about old problems in a new way. And that was the spirit of the show, to go to really smart people who've spent their lives thinking about a big issue and ask them to rethink it now, given everything we've been mm-hmm. through.
So this time last year, as the world was plunging headlong into this crisis, there was so much coverage about what it would do to the world in the short and long term. And some of these were really quite scary doomsday scenarios. But then there was also a kind of a utopian undercurrent to some of it as well, that, you know, the climate would be magically healed because we're all stopped, you know, none of us are commuting or flying anymore.
Right.
1 year on, now that, you know, there are vaccines in and parts of the world, at least, are emerging from this crisis, and we have a better view about where we're going from here, what's the impression that you're getting from your guests on this show? Are they hopeful that we do have the capacity to build back better?
So broadly, yes. The guests I've picked and the ones we've spoken to, maybe by design, maybe just because that's their disposition, have all been quite optimistic. They all seem to be projecting a sense of things can be better. Again, we're in this unprecedented moment where, if you think about the massive amounts of stimulus that governments, rich governments, have pumped into the global economy, there's suddenly all this money sloshing around that could be used for good, that could be used to really boost green investments, that could be used to rethink infrastructure, that could be used to make the government and the economy a little bit more bottom up instead of top down. But it's not all positive. And I say this in part because I'm also sort of living this dual life right now, where on the one hand, during the day, in New York City, things seem great. And most of the people I know here are vaccinated and we're excited about life coming back to normal. But, you know, I often wake up in the mornings to messages from friends and family in India, and things are really bad there. They still are. There have been a lot of deaths. The COVID rates have soared so high. There's almost nobody who doesn't know someone who's either died or been really badly affected by COVID. And given that sort of duality that I feel, that I see every day, I know that around the world, a lot of people are emerging from the pandemic at different speeds or not emerging at all. And that's where it's harder to be hopeful. And so throughout this series, we've been very conscious as well to sort of be sensitive to that fact that not everyone is emerging at the same speed. And the way in which the world has handled the pandemic hasn't really been that equal.
So you've got two episodes out now, the first on climate change with John Kerry, which we're going to hear in just a second, and the second on public health. I know you've got some incredibly distinguished guests to come. Are you at liberty to give us a little bit of a preview of what's coming up in the series?
Ooh, yes, I am. So the ones that are taped, let's talk about those. Excited about the episode on capitalism and inequality. There's been so much talk over the last few years about how capitalism is just broken as a system and what needs to be done to fix it. And so I have two amazing guests to talk about that. Mariana Mazzucato, who is an Italian economist. She's consulted by world leaders all the time, including the Pope, to sort of explain how to build back better. And she talks a lot about stakeholder capitalism. The other guest with her is Raghuram Rajan, who is the former central bank head in India. So again, two very different perspectives on how to fix the things that are broken within capitalism. There's also an interview coming up with Dr. Bernice King about racism in the United States, looking back at the last year of BLM and the ways in which America can really tackle the persistent and pernicious problems of racism going forward. And then I'm also excited about an episode on U.S.-China geopolitics, just in terms of how to reframe the relationship between these two countries and how to navigate a world in which the two are necessarily competing, but they also need to cooperate on things like climate change. And that one's with Kevin Rudd, who's a former Australian prime minister, but also a real expert on China. He's a Mandarin speaker. He's the president of Asia Society and just a big brain on the issue. So those are a few of the things I'm really looking forward to.
Wow, incredible lineup. Can't wait. So today our listeners are going to hear your interview with John Kerry about climate change. And I have to ask before we get to it, how did you know that John Kerry's favorite drink was rum punch?
I knew you were going to ask me that. look, you know, you and I know this. We all do research in a range of ways for our guests and for things that we do. And I listened to a few of John Kerry's interviews on TV and on podcasts, you know, and it ranged, there was a wide range. I mean, there was Fareed Zakaria's interview, there were other interviews with the usual suspects. But I have to say the one that I kind of found the most interesting and learned the most from was Amy Schumer's podcast. And she... Yeah, I mean, she has a great podcast. She just happened to be, I think she was in Martha's Vineyard. She happened to sort of figure out that John Kerry was there at the same time and just called him over. And they have this terrific discussion. She has a wonderful way of just sort of making complex issues very accessible. And she really did that with Kerry. And that's where it emerged. The guy really likes a rum punch. It's what he would love to be doing, sipping a rum punch on a beach if he wasn't tackling climate change.
That was Ravi Agrawal. And here now is the episode Global Reboot, US Climate Envoy John Kerry, from our very own Foreign Policy.
Hello and welcome to Global Reboot, a new podcast from Foreign Policy in partnership with the Doha Forum. I'm Ravi Agrawal, FP's Editor-in-Chief. Depending on where you are in the world right now, your country is either still struggling with the COVID crisis or just starting to see a way out. In New York City, where I live, things are finally returning to normal. But in India, where I grew up and where much of my family still lives, the rate of infection and death remain mind-boggling. Here at Foreign Policy, we've spent much of the past year covering the pandemic and thinking about what the world will look like when COVID finally recedes. For this project, we decided to do something slightly different. Over the course of 8 episodes, we'll explore what the world could look like. What if instead of going back to business as usual, world leaders decide to turn this crisis into an opportunity? What if we could all learn sweeping lessons from COVID? Not just about public health and the economy, but also about the other big challenges we face: racial discrimination, the role that technology plays in our lives, the dire threat posed by climate change. On each episode, we'll tackle one formidable issue by talking to the smartest thinkers around. Our goal is not just to understand the issue, but to figure out how we as a global community can do better. We're starting the series by talking to John Kerry, who serves as President Biden's climate envoy. Of course, Kerry was also a senator for many years and a presidential candidate in 2004. In the past few years, Kerry has tried to solve some of the world's most difficult problems. Middle East peace, the matter of Iranian nukes, the situation in Afghanistan. Now he's focused on the threat to our environment, which has become so ominous, it's hard to imagine a more pressing issue.
Sea levels are rising more rapidly than previously thought, and the key to understanding the extent of the problem are ice sheets.
More species are now threatened with extinction than at any other point in human history.
Looking at how climate change is contributing to these severe wildfires, take a look at federal...
Watch, major protests have been disrupting cities across the world as they demand action on climate change. The group...
President Biden has opened a major global climate summit with a call to world leaders to step up.
Because scientists tell us that this is the decisive decade. This is the decade we must make decisions that will avoid the worst consequences of the climate crisis.
Secretary Kerry, welcome.
You look very, very intellectual with all those books behind you.
They're all fake books.
I don't think so, but anyway, happy to be with you.
It's a real pleasure to get this time with you. Thank you so much. You know, ahead of this interview, when I was speaking to one of your advisors, I was told that climate change is the issue really that fills your heart. You took part in the first Earth Day in 1970, joining millions of Americans in teach-ins to educate the public about environmental challenges. And you met your wife, Teresa, at the first UN climate conference in 1992. Tell us a bit more about why this issue matters to you so much.
Well, my mother was a great environmentalist. I grew up by the seashore of Massachusetts and on the ocean and in the ocean. And I have long had an appreciation for my surroundings. I think also that it's life and death at this point. I mean, anybody who has children and grandchildren has to stop and think about our responsibility generationally to the world around us. And we're not doing so well there. But it's not the only issue that has animated me through my life. You know, I came back from a war that I fought in and thought it was wrong and fought against that war. And during my time in the Senate, I was outspoken on issues of war and peace. I think that, you know, one of the things that has guided me, which is every day is extra, which is a saying that those of us who are lucky enough to come back from a war alive said and sort of adopted as a credo. And I think there's a responsibility that goes with survival that requires you to make sure you make the most of those extra days.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you tend to take on the biggest possible issues one could imagine. I mean, Vietnam, Iraq, Middle East peace, the Iran nuclear deal, and now this. You could be sipping a rum punch on a beach somewhere right now.
I love a rum punch. And it'd be plenty satisfying if you felt like you'd sort of gotten something done. But when things are getting worse, it's pretty hard, I think, to fully enjoy that as much as you'd like to.
So much of what you're trying to do and what the Biden administration is projecting, it seems to me, is a reset, you know, a sense of American leadership on combating climate change. But I have to say that there are many leaders around the world that haven't forgotten the Trump era.
Global warming and that, and a lot of it's a hoax.
And they know that Trump or Trumpism could be back in 4 years.
The United States will withdraw.
But leaving the Paris Agreement was viewed by many environmentalists and world leaders as taking a huge step backward.
What happens next?
That's the big mystery.
And I think I know more about the environment than most people.
How do you reassure leaders who worry about the extent of America's commitment? What do you say when they express fears about a return of Trumpism?
I personally don't believe it will be possible for Trump to come back and Trumpism, because I think that the course that we're on is one that America is going to embrace and feel very good about. But there are two things that I do say to those leaders. One is, even while Donald Trump was in office over 4 years, and even while he pulled out of the Paris Agreement, the fact is that 37 governors in the United States and the District of Columbia stayed in the Paris Agreement. And those 37 governors and District of Columbia represent 80% of the population of our country, and they had renewable portfolio laws, which they executed, and they did. They implemented them, Republican and Democrat alike. So I don't think the return of someone who denies facts, denies truth, denies evidence, denies science, I don't think that's going to move America now. Secondly, and I think this is the far more powerful argument, when you have trillions of dollars that are being invested in these new technologies and moving into this new energy marketplace, that's going to be such a powerful job creator and such a powerful moneymaker. We're going to see the marketplace firmly setting a course for the new energy future, for the new products, and no politician could come along and pull people away from the good jobs, the good salaries, and the money being made. Not going to happen.
On the American side of things, how much of the financing you need for green initiatives is tied to the infrastructure bill, and what happens if that doesn't pass?
Well, there are certainly things that President Biden has proposed that just are plain common sense infrastructure projects that will have an impact on our emissions, on climate. For instance, if you build out a smarter energy grid where you actually can send power produced in one part of the country, but you can send it to another part of the country, that advantages everybody. It can help reduce costs. It's a far more efficient way to distribute energy. The country that went to the moon and invented the internet and has come up with the vaccines and knows how to build and create, we clearly can do this. It's not a lack of capacity, it's a lack of political will. And the truth is, American citizens, all of them, benefit from an effective energy grid which guarantees a good source of energy for their homes, for their workplaces. It's long overdue for us. And it's shameful because actually other people have far more efficient provision of energy in some of their countries than we do. We need to get our act together.
You know, you used to be a politician, Secretary Kerry, and I'm curious, how do you make green initiatives more politically acceptable?
So-called scientific community, just like the so-called media.
And under Kamala Harris and Joe Biden are proposing is one of the most radical ideas.
About science. It's not about facts. This is really about government controlling almost every aspect of your life.
How do you get around that and bring along a part of the country that often hears in the media that climate change isn't even a problem?
Well, I think that the vast proportion, I mean, the Americans, the majority of Americans clearly know that climate change is happening and they support doing things that are common sense. Republicans, both in the House and the Senate, who recognize that the bridge connecting their city to one side of the river to the other is not a Republican bridge or Democrat bridge. It doesn't have any ideology. It's a bridge. It's an American bridge. Our grandparents and our parents built that out without hesitation. The great construction periods of the 1930s and 40s and 50s and 60s, Dwight Eisenhower building America's great highway system. They built the America we're living in today. And we need to be willing to invest in the America that we want our grandchildren and our children to be able to live in the future. I think it's a matter of common sense, and I think Americans will want to do this.
Let's talk about China. This administration has been fairly tough on Beijing.
Take on directly the challenges posed by our prosperity, security, and democratic values by our most serious competitor, China. Will confront China's economic.
It's accused China of conducting a genocide against the Uyghurs. It's engaged Taiwan.
On China's attack on human rights.
But amid all of this, the Biden White House also really needs China as a partner in fighting climate change.
But we are ready to work with Beijing when it's in America's interest to do so.
How do you, Secretary Kerry, partition this one issue, climate change, from all the other arenas of competition?
Well, I think historically, Ravi, we've always been able as a country, and big nations, powerful nations that have differences, have usually we've been able to come together and be able to try to negotiate and resolve certain differences. An example of that is Ronald Reagan in the Soviet Union. He consistently called it the evil empire. He told them to tear down the wall. He was a great advocate for freedom and for democracy. And ultimately, he met with Gorbachev in Reykjavik, and they came to an agreement that it really didn't make a lot of sense to have 50,000 warheads pointing at each other on a hair trigger and to be living with that day-to-day danger. Richard Nixon in China, originally, in the opening up during the 1970s. These are the things that make a difference. And right now, climate is enough of an imperative for all of our countries. We have differences on economic rules, on cyber. We have other differences of human rights, differences of geostrategic interest, but those differences do not have to get in the way of something that is as critical as dealing with climate. And when I was in China the other day, we negotiated, and we negotiated back and forth in good faith. We didn't have to insult each other or shout at each other. We had a serious, tough conversation, but we managed to find the place and the way to be able to agree and move forward. My sense is the Chinese know that there is a benefit to both of us being able to resolve the climate crisis because our citizens are deeply affected by our failure to do so.
I know you have a long personal relationship with your Chinese counterpart, Xie Zhenhua, the climate envoy. Tell us what you know about him. What animates him?
He cares about this issue. Xie Zhenhua has been working on this issue for years. People who've been involved in these negotiations for those many years have great respect for him because he's been able to thread the needle between the ideological tug or the other differences and stay focused on the climate issue. He's a professional. He's well-read, well-studied. And I think President Xi and the Chinese leadership have great confidence in him. He was appointed an interlocutor after I'd been appointed, I think precisely because we did know each other and we have worked together and we've crisscrossed the world on this issue. And I think if you talk to anybody who has been part of the conferences of the United Nations over the years, they will express their respect for Xie Zhenhua.
You know, in speaking to other people for this interview, one of the things I heard is that leaders around the world, they know that when they're talking to you, you have a direct line to President Biden, and that's important to them. How much support does Xie Zhenhua have with Xi Jinping, with the powers that be in Beijing to advance a progressive climate agenda?
He has direct access to the president of China.
Put us in the room where it happens when you're negotiating with the Chinese. What is it like? How do they approach climate change? And in this climate where there's so much tough rhetoric, there's so much of a need for both sides to appear tough and appear to be, you know, playing to domestic constituencies. And here you are with your counterparts trying to talk about something much bigger that's apolitical. How do you do that?
We talked in private. I think we both know that nothing is served by having a television camera sort of invading you at that particular moment. And we talked with respect, with mutual respect, which is the only way to really get something done, I think. I think you have to know what your bottom line is, and you have to have a pretty good understanding of what theirs may be. And you're trying to find the ways to get the cracks and find the mutual agreement. Clearly, he was operating with negotiating instructions. I think there were some limitations. I think President Biden may have given me greater latitude to try to get things done, because we're the ones who are actually trying to move them somewhere. And they're the ones who have a certain path that they've predetermined, which we're trying to move them off of and onto a what we think is a better and more achievable path, and a path that will have better consequences for the world as well as for China. And you go back and forth. That's the nature of a negotiation. I think that they are well-practiced and strong negotiators, but then again, so are we. And it makes for a pretty good negotiation.
Well, one of the things you've talked about, Secretary Kerry, is about a new tracing program with satellites measuring in real time the emissions footprint of corporations and countries. Tell us a bit more about how that works and how you could use that to enforce compliance.
Well, this is a system that Al Gore and a team of folks have been working on for some period of time, which is to connect a satellite structure that has the ability with modern day sensor to measure in real time the carbon footprint of a particular company or a particular building, certainly a particular country, a particular city. And that way there's going to be much greater visibility, transparency, and accountability on what people are doing to step up. And that kind of accountability will drive popular demand and discontent with the absence of action to focus on those particular entities.
You know, I remember one of the things that ended up making China think so much more about pollution and therefore climate change more than a decade ago is when the U.S. Embassy in Beijing began to monitor air quality readings, and the same right. In New Delhi, another highly polluted city. And that ended up, in a sense, generating more civic interest and civic pressure on those governments to do more.
Public scrutiny is a very critical component of this. I think no nation wants to have its citizens saying, wait a minute, we're not behaving like a good neighbor, and we're not acting in our own interest, and our own people are breathing bad air or drinking bad water, and people in public life have to be concerned about those kinds of things. It certainly drove some of the activity within China during a period of time. Now we have to hope that China, which is stepping up as a global power, will recognize that you can't be a responsible global leader if you're not reducing emissions and meeting the responsibilities of the crisis of climate.
Given all of the lockdowns of the last year and everything the world has been through, what lessons do you think the world has learned from its response to COVID-19 that can be applied to the fight against climate change?
I'm worried about that, Robbie. I think there are rhetorical lessons spoken, but I'm not sure there are lessons applied. Particularly with respect to the climate challenge, we seem to be building back, not better, but just using the same old, rather than using it as a breakpoint opportunity and saying we're going to go out and deploy more renewable quickly and do the following. According to the International Energy Association, Fatih Birol, who heads it up,
what we see is this year, global emissions will increase substantially, mainly driven by coal.
Dr. Birol has said that we are on track right now to have an historic high increase rate of carbon dioxide in the buildback. That is not good. and that does not augur well for where we're headed. So that is why it is so imperative that every major emitting country start to grapple with this question of current emissions. We should not be bringing new coal-fired power plants online right now, but there are new plants coming online in too many countries, and there are better alternatives for those countries that exist right now. So that's the place we're at, which is really the heart and soul of this negotiation we have yet to really break through on, to get people to stop more definitively this new coal power in favor of renewable and start trying to build a different kind of more efficient grid that is more friendly to the future.
It must be hard and tiring and sometimes depressing to deal with an issue like climate change, where so much of the news and the issues we're dealing with is all doom and gloom and just seems daunting. Let me flip that. What makes you optimistic today?
But look what we're doing with vaccines today. In the United States, we will have a vaccine for every person that needs it within a very short span of time. I wish people were all ready to use them and take them. But the fact is that we're doing things. There's just our breakthroughs in technologies and other things. The possibilities are enormous, in my judgment. So my optimism is that there are things we've done that have made life better, despite the fact that we're on this terrible course in the long run with respect to what we're doing with the environment. But I think we can turn that around. And I'm confident that just as we went to the moon with a confidence, not knowing exactly what we were going to do or when we were going to get there, but we rose to the challenge. And in many other ways, I think we have proven again and again that when we put our minds to something, we can and will get it done. And I think that's our record. And I believe in that. And it keeps me feeling optimistic and hopeful about the future. There are days I get frustrated and even angry, because I think we're just being dumb about some things, to ignore certain realities, to avoid scientific evidence, to turn our backs on truth is pretty infuriating. And to be delayed in the ability to do many of these things because of that is totally infuriating. But what's your choice? You got to keep pushing, you keep going. I think life is sort of built up on these incremental additions that we get. And hopefully, ultimately, you get where you want to go.
My last question. If you were to set yourself a goal of feeling good about 2021 and how it's gone, and allow yourself a rum punch on a beach on December 31st, how would the year have gone for that to happen?
Well, we would have ended the scourge of COVID-19 in a way that, or at least gotten control over it. We're not going to end it per se. But we'd have gotten sufficient control over it that people have a feeling we're returning to a more normal, new normal life that is less interrupted by the precautions that we have to take. And I think it would be by knowing that in Glasgow, the world did set out on a path where we have a real shot and the best shot of holding the Earth's temperature to 1.5 degrees. And of heading towards a future that is 2050 net zero, that all of that is achievable because the world came together in Glasgow to make it possible. I'll have plenty of rum on that one.
So will I. Secretary Kerry, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Secretary John Kerry is the US Special Presidential Climate Envoy. Thanks for listening to Global Reboot. I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. Our podcast is a partnership between Foreign Policy and Doha Forum. Our production staff includes Rosie Julin, Rob Sachs, Dan Efron, Darcy Palder, and Zamon Perez. Next time on Global Reboot, how COVID-19 and what we've learned from the pandemic will shape our public health going forward.
I think we have learned that we are more interdependent and more connected to one another's outcomes and futures than we might be comfortable thinking about.
Science is going to move much, much faster, and it's going to be more collaborative, more global.
That's next week on Global Reboot.
And that was the episode, US Climate Envoy John Kerry. My thanks to Ravi and the podcast team for sharing this new series with us. That's all for Foreign Policy Playlist. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe. And if you want to suggest a great podcast, please email us at podcasts@foreignpolicy.com. The show is hosted by me, Amy McKinnon, and is produced by Rob Sachs, Rosie Julin, and Simone Perez. Our executive producer of podcasts is Dan Efron.